All right, we've finished the basics of transcription. Slide 7 is where we're starting today, and what we see here is the notion of transcription factors. Just like I told you in an earlier lecture about the control of the cell cycle, the word factor often refers to some sort of specialized protein. This is another example of that usage. Transcription factors are proteins. But they're called transcription factors because they control transcription. And therefore they control gene expression, because gene expression starts with transcription. A gene is turned off, in other words, so to speak, until it is transcribed. And it's not going to be transcribed, like we learned last time, until RNA polymerase comes along and binds to the promoter, like we talked about. Well, usually RNA polymerase by itself is not able to bind to the promoter. First, before that can happen, various proteins, each called transcription factors, have to come and bind to the promoter region first. Then RNA polymerase is able to bind, and that's what starts transcription. So this is a way to make sure that conditions are right for that gene to be turned on. Now to 8, and what we're looking at here is pre-mRNA in a eukaryotic organism. Remember, I've already talked about the fact that transcription makes the mRNA, but in a eukaryotic cell, that transcript, that mRNA that's produced, is not yet ready to be used in the second part of gene expression, which is translation. It has to be post-transcriptionally modified. And we're looking at part of that modification here. Part of the post-transcriptional modification is to add these yellow ends. And these ends are called the 5' cap, which of course is named for the fact that it's put on the 5' end of the transcript. The transcript before this happens is the red part. You add a 5' cap, and you add what's called a poly-A tail, because it's a lot of A nucleotides. And that is important. That's an important part of post-transcriptional modification because of this additional step that eukaryotes have to take in that they need to get the mRNA out of the nucleus where it's created by transcription and into the cytoplasm where translation takes place. Well, putting these yellow ends on allows this thing to get out of the nucleus by interacting with those protein complexes that make up the nuclear pores of the nuclear envelope. It allows this thing to be strung out into the cytoplasm. But that's only part of post-transcriptional modification. Slide 9 shows you another important part. So here we have on the top, this is still called pre-mRNA, even though it's already been slightly modified, because it's not yet fully modified. And what we see here is that the red part, which is the transcript before it got capped by the yellow parts, is broken into red and pink sections. And notice that they are labeled exons and introns. Introns got named because they are intervening sequences. Intervening means coming between. And so they are sequences of nucleotides that come between these other sequences that are called exons. Exons get their name because they get expressed, meaning they are going to be in the final mature version of mRNA, and they therefore are going to be codons that get read by the ribosome to produce a polypeptide. The introns won't be, because the introns get removed as this second major part of post-transcriptional modification of mRNA. Okay, so the cell has to be able to recognize where introns begin and end, take them out, and then sew together all the exons end to end to make this mature mRNA that we see at the bottom. And that's what then goes on and gets translated, or gets involved in the process of translation. The code that's in this red part of the mRNA is used to tell the ribosome how many and which kinds of amino acids to string together end to end to make a polypeptide. That's what translation is, the actual building.
Why is the intron end of the mRNA?
Well, that's something I can't answer for in this course. It would take too long to talk about that because there's evolutionary arguments about that. But I will mention something about it that will hopefully make it a little bit clearer. First, let's look at 10, though. And what we see in 10 is the molecular machine that is responsible for doing this modification of removing the introns and sewing together the exons. Oh, by the way, did I tell you that exons got their name because they are expressed? Yeah, I think I did say that. Expressed. Okay. So we have just a little bit of the mRNA shown on the top. Just one intron here, but there would be more introns if you saw the whole thing. Anyway, this molecular machine is called a spliceosome, which literally means splicing body. And it is made of combinations of RNA and protein. Now, this whole thing is the spliceosome, as you see labeled. But notice in the upper left, you have something that's called an SNRNP, which is short for small nuclear ribonucleoprotein. And some people just call them SNRPs for short, for the acronym. But a small nuclear ribonucleoprotein is itself a combination of two kinds of molecules. It's partly RNA and partly protein. That's why it's a ribonucleoprotein rather than just an RNA. Well, the kind of RNA, which is shown as the red ribbon here, that's in an SNRNP is a small nuclear RNA, small nuclear ribonucleic acid. That's just one of many kinds of RNA. Okay, so this is a different RNA that we haven't talked about yet. But when you package that SNRNA with protein, you make a single SNRNP. Multiple SNRNPs then get together, along with still other proteins, to form this overall spliceosome. And it's the RNA part of this spliceosome that is able to recognize, by complementarity of its nucleic acids, the beginnings and ends of introns. And the enzymatic activity is that it splices, makes cuts between exon and intron, and then between intron and exon, cleaves out the intron, so you see the cutout intron here, and then hooks the two exons together. In other words, it splices it. Now, the cutout intron that you see here is worthless as far as gene expression is concerned. This is basically waste at this point, but it's still valuable molecularly because it's RNA. It's made out of nucleotides, so it can be digested into individual nucleotides and reused to build other RNA molecules. No, the rest of these other proteins are just pure proteins, and when you combine those with the SNRPs, you make the splices. Yeah.
Does the spliceosome itself actually
do
like the suturing of exons?
Yeah, it does, which is an important step, right? Because if you didn't have that ability, you would just ruin the mRNA, cut it into pieces. Okay, 11, this is where I'll just partially answer your question. 11, we see that the simple gene, just by example, has three exons and two introns. The introns, of course, get spliced out as part of RNA processing that's shown here. That's specifically post-transcriptional processing. And then translation assembles the polypeptide. You see the polypeptide on the bottom. It's a single polypeptide, one ribbon, right? One continuous chain of amino acids that doesn't branch. But notice that the overall polypeptide is broken into domains, which, as you see by the color coding, correspond to different exons. Well, a domain is very similar to a functional group. Remember, functional groups, which are called functional groups because they are not entire molecules. They're just collections of atoms that are part of a bigger molecule, but they give that molecule a specific function, right? Like a carboxyl group, for instance. Similarly, a domain is not an entire polypeptide. It's just part of the polypeptide, but it has a specific shape by itself. And because of that specific shape of that domain, the entire polypeptide will have a specific function. Now, the other part here, and this goes to your question, is that the pre-mRNA is always going to be the same because it just comes directly from one-to-one correspondence from the gene, nucleotide for nucleotide, right? You always make, if the gene gets expressed, if it gets transcribed, you always make the same pre-mRNA. But it's possible under different circumstances to either include all the exons or to include only some of them. In other words, it's possible to sometimes treat exons as introns and cut them out, which means you would have a different polypeptide that wouldn't include the same domains, even though it's coming from the same gene. So this is called alternative mRNA splicing. And this is why a single gene can actually code for more than one possible protein, which is why that's just one of the reasons why one gene, one polypeptide is still not correct, as we've talked about before. And this is why we can have fewer genes than we actually have proteins that we can produce because of alternative RNA splicing. Okay, that finishes transcription, bringing us to 12. And the second major part of gene expression, of course, is translation, which we're seeing happening here in as a just kind of an introductory summary slide. The cartoon here involves translation involves many different RNA molecules, but it also includes three different major categories of RNA. All right? So the categories that are involved are mRNA, of course, that's the red transcript. mRNA is carrying the code at this point. DNA's job is done. mRNA is standing as the code for how to build the polypeptide. So, of course, messenger RNA is one of the categories. Another category is ribosomal RNA, or rRNA, small r RNA. That's still another category of RNA. And as its name implies, ribosomal RNA is a component of a ribosome. All you see as the ribosome here is just this brown two-piece structure that we've talked about before. But molecularly speaking, it's a mixture of two kinds of molecules, two categories of macromolecules. rRNA is, of course, a nucleic acid, and the rest of the structure of a ribosome is made of proteins. So it's partly RNA, partly proteins. And by the way, the RNA part of a ribosome gives it catalytic activity. So we're used to thinking of proteins serving as catalysts. We call those enzymes, and they are really important, like we've talked about before. But proteins are not the only biological molecules that can act as catalysts. RNAs can as well. And we don't call them enzymes in that case because that word is reserved for protein catalysts, catalysts that are made out of protein. Proteins that are made out of RNA are called ribozymes. Same ending, indicating that they're catalysts, but they're made out of ribonucleic acids instead of proteins. Okay, so that's the second major category of RNA that's involved in translation. And the third is called transfer RNA, or tRNA, which are all these little teal-colored bent pegs that you see here. And think about what translation accomplishes. It is the building of the actual polypeptide, one amino acid at a time. To do that, to do it successfully, it's not a random process, right? To do it successfully, you have to have exactly the right sequence of amino acids, because as we've discussed, that primary structure, which is the sequence, determines how it folds up into shape for secondary and tertiary structure, and therefore that determines how it will work as whatever kind of protein it is, doing whatever function it is. Shape is everything for proteins. So you have to get that sequence correct. And that's what the code in mRNA is all about. The code, as we've talked about, is a sequence of three-letter codons, each like a word, that corresponds in the genetic code to a... Each codon in the genetic code corresponds to a specific amino acid. So by reading the messenger RNA transcript one codon at a time, the ribosome is able to know which kind of amino acid to add one at a time to what is the growing sequence of amino acids. This is a peptide. Peptide is just a general word meaning some collection of amino acids. It will eventually be a polypeptide once there are enough of them, but it starts as one and then two and then three, gets longer and longer. The ribosome, in a sense, is the molecular machine that reads the codons, and that involves ribosomal RNA, and of course messenger RNA is in here being read, but it's the transfer RNA, and this is why it's called this, that actually brings in each amino acid, the specific kind that's required based on that codon that's being read, and brings it in to be added to the sequence. Okay? Now, tRNA is a category. That's just one category of RNA, but there are many different kinds of tRNAs. And that's because there are multiple different kinds of amino acids, right? All organisms use the same set of 20 amino acids. We call those the biological amino acids. So, to maintain the integrity of the information, by which I mean to ensure that when a codon is read in the messenger RNA, you're bringing in just the right kind of amino acid and no other kind of amino acid, there are different kinds of tRNA, each of which is allowed to carry or transfer just one kind of amino acid. That's why there are multiple different tRNAs, because there are multiple different kinds of amino acids. Each specific tRNA, though, if it's carrying any amino acid, is allowed to carry just the kind that it's supposed to carry, right? And that's what maintains the integrity of the information.
So it's only one.
Well, directly, and this is where I'm just headed, so hopefully that'll make more sense. So tRNA, any individual tRNA, one of these bluish pegs, can exist in either of three forms. So it depends on when. Okay? One possibility, which you see right here, this one coming out after the red arrow, one possibility is for a tRNA to not be carrying anything. And we call that an uncharged tRNA. Uncharged doesn't have anything to do with electrical charge. It just means it's not carrying an amino acid. That's why it has just this little black thing hanging off of it with nothing connected to it. So that's one category. Now, if a tRNA is not uncharged, that means it is carrying something. So it's charged, but there's two ways that that can happen. We use two different names, depending on the situation, for charged tRNAs. If a tRNA is carrying exactly one amino acid, like this one carrying glycine, GLY, then it is not only charged, but more specifically than that, it is called an aminoacyl tRNA. Because it's carrying one amino acid. I'll try to get a non-invisible pen. All right, this is an aminoacyl tRNA. Any one of these ones carrying exactly one is also an aminoacyl tRNA. Any given aminoacyl tRNA is only allowed to carry one kind of amino acid and none of the other 19. Okay, the other possibility for a charged tRNA, one that's carrying something, is for it to be directly connected to one amino acid, but then the amino acid itself is connected to a string of other amino acids. In other words, instead of a tRNA carrying a single amino acid, it can be carrying a peptide of some length. All right? It's also charged in that case, but since it's carrying multiple amino acids connected as a string, it's called a peptidyl tRNA. And this one that is in the middle of the bottom, middle of the ribosome on the bottom with phenylalanine, tryptophan, and so on, this is a peptidyl tRNA at the moment because it's carrying a string of amino acids rather than just one, or rather than zero, which would be an uncharged tRNA. Yeah.
With the peptidyl tRNA, when there's multiple attached to it, does it stay? Like, does it all stay, or does it?
No, that's a good question. It's going to be this, as we'll see in the next slide coming up, this whole string of amino acids that's currently being carried by this peptidyl tRNA is going to be transferred over to this glycine that's being carried by this aminoacyl tRNA. And that's going to then change this aminoacyl tRNA into a peptidyl tRNA. There aren't going to be any on this one, which is going to turn it into an uncharged tRNA. This one that's uncharged and being ejected, just moments ago, it was carrying everything except for this phenylalanine. Okay? So any given tRNA, I mean the three categories, any given tRNA can be any of those three depending on when it is. They don't permanently stay aminoacyl tRNAs or any of the other categories. So let's look at 13 now, which is concerned with just a tRNA, the general tRNA structure. A tRNA, of course, is an RNA. And remember that unlike DNA, RNA is single-stranded. There's other differences we've talked about as well, but a tRNA, just like a typical RNA, is a single strand. So this looks like it, kind of like it's a double strand, but it's all one strand that folds back on itself. So there are places where there's complementarity and it bonds together like two strands of a DNA, but it's all still one strand. And what we're looking at on the top is the so-called cloverleaf arrangement. This is if you force it into two dimensions, flatten it out. It wouldn't have this shape by itself. But if you did that, you would see it has this clover leaf because it's like the three leaflets of a clover, these three hairpin loops, as they're called. And although they're all there, it's the middle hairpin loop, which is at the bottom of the cartoon here, of the top figure, that is particularly important. Now, all of these A's, T's, A's, U's, C's, and G's are nucleotides, of course. That's what an RNA is made out of. But notice that there are three nucleotides at the bottom of this figure that are labeled anticodon. That's a particularly important sequence. The word anticodon refers to the fact that this sequence, whatever it is, and that depends on which version of a tRNA you're looking at. This one happens to have AAG. The anticodon, though, is named anticodon because it is complementary to, which is in a sense opposite to, a codon. Okay? So if you use complementarity rules, AAG would match up with UUC, right, in the genetic code. That's why it's called an anticodon. And this is very important in making sure that only the right kind of amino acid gets brought in when the codon that specifies that amino acid is being read by the ribosome. Because whatever the anticodon is for a given version of tRNA, that determines the only type of amino acid that's able to be carried by that type of tRNA. So if you look up UUC in the genetic code, which you could do in those 64 that I showed you, or 61 of them specify amino acids, you look up its amino acid, that would be the only kind of amino acid this particular kind of tRNA is ever allowed to carry, directly connected to it. And by directly, I mean at the 3' end. That 3' end is the part of the tRNA that can be connected directly to an amino acid. That's where the charging of an amino acid takes place. So the uncharged ones in that previous slide where you just had a black line hanging off of it, that's the 3' end. If it gets charged, though, it can only be charged with the kind of amino acid that corresponds to a codon that is opposite its anticodon, or complementary to its anticodon. The bottom figures just show you a more three-dimensional shape, which is why they're represented as these bent rods, because they kind of have that bent rod shape in three dimensions. But the anticodon is really the really important informational part of the tRNA. Okay, now to 14. Here we have the process of charging a tRNA. And this happens more or less the same way for all of the different kinds of tRNAs, but, well, it happens about the same way for all of them. It's going to involve, not surprisingly, an enzyme to do this. Right, the charging of a tRNA is the connection of an amino acid to the tRNA, which is a chemical reaction that gets sped up by a catalyst, an enzyme. The grayish thing that kind of looks like an embryo, human embryo, is the specialized kind of catalyst or enzyme that does this charging of the tRNA, and it's called aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. It's not an aminoacyl tRNA. An aminoacyl tRNA is what I told you it is. An aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is the enzyme that creates an aminoacyl tRNA by bringing together or synthesizing an uncharged tRNA and the specific kind of amino acid that that kind of tRNA is allowed to carry. So just as there are different kinds of aminoacyl tRNA, there are different kinds of tRNAs, each corresponding to a different amino acid, there are also different versions of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase that work on just a specific kind of tRNA. All right, but notice the complex active site. This allows in just the right kind of amino acid and just the right corresponding kind of tRNA that's allowed to carry it. And they get together through the enzyme's help to charge the tRNA, and then the charged tRNA is released. This amino acid that it is able to carry corresponds to its anticodon, corresponds to the codon that the anticodon corresponds to, I should say. And so this is happening all the time in the cytoplasm, meaning you have a whole big pool of tRNAs. At any given moment, some of them are uncharged, some of them are aminoacyl tRNAs, and some of them are peptidyl tRNAs. But before any tRNA can take part in translation to help build the polypeptide, it first has to be charged with its specific kind of amino acid to make it into an aminoacyl tRNA. That's happening not at the ribosome, but just in the cytoplasm, creating a bunch of different copies of all the various kinds of charged aminoacyl tRNAs. So they're all ready to go, each one carrying its own kind of amino acid, and there's many copies of each, until one of them gets called next. And by called next, I mean when a codon comes up and gets read as the current codon, and it, in the genetic code you look that up and it specifies a certain amino acid, well, just that kind of already charged aminoacyl tRNA that's carrying that amino acid will be able to be allowed into the ribosome to bring that specific amino acid in. Yeah.
Has there ever been a time where the enzyme didn't make the right amino acid?
Yes, any mistakes can happen. They don't very often, but that's one example of how you can have something go wrong and therefore have a different protein than what you're supposed to have. That's pretty rare, though. Yeah. And also, even if it does happen, it would only happen once, right? On the other hand, if you have a mistake that actually changes the DNA, the cell doesn't know it's wrong, and now it's going to keep obeying that DNA, so that's a permanent change. Yeah.
So my question is sort of like, is ATP available for all these
problems? Yeah, well, this is just one of many reasons why we need ATP, and you die without it pretty quickly. What were you going to say?
Is there like a correction system for this part, like there is for transcription, or
Well, if there is, I don't know the particulars of it, but it's pretty specific to begin with, meaning that these enzymes don't allow in the wrong kind of tRNA because there's no correspondence between their anticodon and the part of the enzyme that reads that. So that's actually a built-in safety.
Would you say this is even less likely to have mistakes than transcription is?
I don't know the statistics on that. But like I was just saying, if a mistake does happen, it's only going to affect that one particular polypeptide that's being built. And when an mRNA gets translated into polypeptides, it's not used just once. It's used over and over to make multiple copies. And all the other copies would still be correct because the mistake would only happen in that one instance. Okay, 15. Now let's take a closer look at a ribosome. Keep in mind that there are two ribosomal subunits, right? They have to get together to make a ribosome, and I've talked already about how it's really a lie to show you two ribosomal subunits just by themselves hooked together, because they really don't come together until you first have mRNA connected to one of those. But when the mRNA is present, then the two ribosomal subunits can come together and kind of clamp the mRNA between the ribosomal subunits. Okay? Now, in the middle cartoon, you can see that there are three slots in this large ribosomal subunit, and they are labeled E, P, and A. Or at least you would read that. In English, we read left to right, so it looks like EPA, but it's really these slots are used in the reverse direction. So A is used, then P, then E. And the reason that they get these letter designations is that the A slot stands for the aminoacyl tRNA binding site, meaning this is where an aminoacyl tRNA carrying just one amino acid can come in and bring its specific amino acid. The reason that it's allowed in and no other kind of tRNA is allowed in is because the A slot is where the current codon is being read. And only a tRNA with an anticodon that is complementary to that codon can come in. That's what ensures the right kind of amino acid is brought in next. The P slot in the middle is short for peptidyl tRNA binding site. And you can see on the bottom figure that at the moment, this tRNA in the P slot is a peptidyl tRNA because it's carrying a string rather than just a single amino acid. And the E slot is the exit slot or ejection slot because, as we'll see, the ribosome shifts by one codon at a time, goes down the length of the mRNA, and when the peptidyl tRNA transfers the string of amino acids it's carrying to the one amino acid being carried by the aminoacyl tRNA, that causes this one that's in the P slot, which is currently a peptidyl tRNA, to become an uncharged tRNA, right? Because it's suddenly going to be carrying nothing. Well, that puts it then, after the shift, into the E slot, and the uncharged tRNA gets ejected. All right? This is not a worthless thing, right? An uncharged tRNA is just now part of the pool that needs to go find its particular version of aminoacyl tRNA synthase, the enzyme, to get recharged with another copy of that only kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry. Okay. And by the way, when the transfer takes place of the peptide being carried by the peptidyl tRNA to the amino acid being carried by the aminoacyl tRNA, that not only makes the peptidyl tRNA an uncharged tRNA, it makes the aminoacyl tRNA now a peptidyl tRNA because it's carrying more than one. So that's the basic. Let's look at the three major parts, starting with 16. Remember that transcription, which is not what we're looking at here. Transcription is the production of the mRNA. Transcription, though, occurred in three phases called initiation, elongation, and termination, right? Well, translation has three phases named exactly the same, even though, of course, different things are happening here. But they're named for the same reasons. Initiation means getting things started, and that's what we're looking at here in 16. So now we can finally see what I've been telling you about the lie that they were showing you when the two ribosomal subunits are put together without anything else there. That doesn't happen. Instead, in initiation, a small ribosomal subunit connects to the messenger RNA, and that happens in a very specific way. The way that the messenger RNA is able to bind to this small subunit is so that it positions its AUG. Remember, AUG is the start codon? So AUG, which is not all the way at the end, it's in somewhere. That AUG gets positioned exactly in the middle of this small subunit so that when the large subunit comes along, that's going to be at the P slot. Alright? But before that large subunit comes along, you also have a tRNA that is carrying the thionine come. Because remember, AUG is not only a start codon, it also codes for methionine. This is why I said that all polypeptides start out with methionine as the first amino acid, whether they need it to be or not. That's because AUG specifies methionine. And here we can see the correspondence between the anticodon and the codon. The codon is AUG, the anticodon is UAC. Well, a tRNA that has UAC is allowed to carry methionine only. That's what makes it come in as first. And then once that's all in place, at the expense of some energy in the form of GTP, very similar to ATP, but it uses guanine instead of adenine, GTP gets dephosphorylated to release energy, and that allows for the rest of the initiation complex to come, which is the large subunit. Okay, the initiation complex is everything we see here on the right. It's the entire ribosome, which is both subunits, large and small, the mRNA itself, and the aminoacyl tRNA, which is the tRNA and methionine that it's carrying. Yeah?
It always
Yes, because AUG is always the first codon. That's what start codon means. If it were some other amino acid in the genetic code other than methionine, then it would always start with that one, but it's methionine. Okay, so you can see that we spend some energy just to create this initiation complex, and that shouldn't surprise you. It shouldn't surprise you at all that building a polypeptide is an expensive process, right? You're making a polymer out of many monomers. Well, each little step is going to require some energy. This is just part of the energy. 17 goes on to show you elongation, which of course refers to adding more and more amino acids to make the polypeptide, the growing polypeptide. And actually, already a few more have been added. We're looking at this a little bit later on into the process, but it's a cycle, so it happens the same way each turn of the cycle. The A site at the top is the currently red codon. Whatever it can be, any of the 64 codons, right? If it's AUG again, that simply means add another methionine. It only functions as the start codon once. Every other time it's red, it says methionine. If it's any one of the three stop codons, then it will stop. But if it's any one of the 61 amino acid specifying codons, then the specific kind of tRNA that is complementary to that codon will be allowed in, and that is bringing just the right kind of amino acid along with it. Then you have to spend some more energy in the form of GTP, and that expense of that energy allows for the peptide, however long it is, that's currently being carried by the peptidyl tRNA occupying the P slot, is transferred to the amino acid that's being carried by the incoming aminoacyl tRNA. And that's what I was saying actually changes the names of these things, because now this peptidyl tRNA, on the bottom you can see it's empty, is an uncharged tRNA because the transfer has been made. And now this former aminoacyl tRNA is a peptidyl tRNA because it's carrying the string, and the string is one more amino acid long. Okay? These are, at the moment, this brief moment, they are actually in the wrong slot based on what they are, right? But with expenditure of even more energy in the form of GTP, this ribosome shifts by one codon down the length of the messenger RNA. And that's what's going to put this uncharged tRNA in the E slot, which is what it should be for an uncharged tRNA, and it will be ejected. And that's what's going to put the new peptidyl tRNA into the P slot. And you're ready, and that's also going to read a new codon now because it shifted by one codon. And that will happen over and over the same way, spending two GTPs per amino acid until the codon that comes to the A slot is any one of the three stop codons. Yeah. Yes. Notice, though, that no tRNA is ever directly connected to anything other than the one it can carry. The reason this is now a peptidyl tRNA is because this peptide was added to the other end of the amino acid. Okay, so it's still directly connected to only the only one it can carry. And yes, it gets longer by one more each time because each aminoacyl tRNA is bringing in one. Right, but that will no longer be elongation. Elongation continues as long as the codon's being read. The next codon being read is any one of the 61 codons that specify amino acids. Any non-stop codon, in other words. And as long as you have GTP available. Okay, then we have 18, which is the termination phase. This happens when any one of these three stop codons reaches the A slot. And it doesn't matter at all which of the three gets read. All three stop codons are identical in their effect. But think back to when I was describing the genetic code. AUG is the start codon, but does double duty because it still specifies an amino acid, methionine. That's not true for any of the stop codons. Each stop codon is a stop codon, and that is it. It does not specify any amino acid. And therefore, there is no such thing as a tRNA with an anticodon that is complementary to any of the three stop codons. Okay? So it's not a tRNA that comes into the A slot when a stop codon is being read. Instead, it's this yellow thing, which you can see is another example of a protein being called a factor. A release factor is this yellow thing. Instead of a tRNA, it's a specialized protein that's able to interact with any one of the three stop codons. And when that happens, that's a signal to the whole ribosome, the whole translation complex, that the final amino acid has already been added in the previous step, which would be the last part of elongation, the last round of elongation. That already happened, and the stop codon tells it you're already done with amino acids. Now it's time to disintegrate the whole complex. So the two ribosomal subunits separate from each other. The messenger RNA comes out. The uncharged tRNA gets ejected, and the polypeptide that it was carrying is now on its own. That's why it's called a free polypeptide. It's no longer connected to a tRNA. And part of that disintegration requires expenditure of even more energy. So you have to spend GTP for initiation. You have to spend a lot of GTP, two per amino acid that gets added in elongation, then you have to spend another couple of GTP just to break the complex down. Now this is how it happens for a single ribosome translating this messenger RNA. But importantly, this messenger RNA isn't used just one time. You don't make just one polypeptide, one copy. The messenger RNA is a code. And as long as that messenger RNA still exists, the same thing can happen. A new ribosome can clamp onto it and do exactly the same thing to make an identical copy of the same polypeptide. So it's reusable, in other words. So when you translate a transcript, you're making many, many identical copies of that polypeptide. And it will continue to happen as long as the RNA is there, which, by the way, you wouldn't want to have happen forever, right? You only want to keep making the protein that you need for as long as you need it. So an important part of the control of gene expression is that messenger RNAs are not allowed to hang around forever. They are kind of pre-programmed to disintegrate after a while, and therefore you'll stop making those polypeptides. Now, if you still do need it, no emergency, right? Because you still have the DNA you can go back to and make a new transcript and keep making more through translation, making more polypeptides through translation. Okay, 19. This cartoon shows you what is called a polyribosome, as you see labeled. A polyribosome is a single messenger RNA transcript, the red ribbon, plus all of the ribosomes that are currently connected to it in translating, creating new polypeptides. So not only is an mRNA reusable, like I was just saying in the last slide, but an mRNA doesn't even have to wait until one ribosome reaches the end before another ribosome can come along and clamp on and start a new polypeptide. Okay, it just has to wait until one polypeptide gets enough down the line so it's out of the way for another ribosome to come and clamp. These different ribosomes that are clamped on here are doing exactly the same thing. They're making identical purple copies of polypeptides. But the farther you get to the right, the longer it's been on that mRNA. It's moving from left to right in this picture. And this one has already stopped. It hit its stop codon, so it's done. This one is almost done. This one's a little bit behind it, and so on. All of those ribosomes plus the one messenger RNA that they're connected to make up a polyribosome. And so this is much more efficient than waiting, right? Why would you wait? Because that would just slow down the whole process. You could make a lot of copies just with one mRNA transcript. And by the way, when a gene gets expressed, when it gets turned on for transcription, you don't have to just make one messenger RNA. You can transcribe it over and over as long as it's turned on. And each one of these identical messenger RNA transcripts can be used multiply to make many copies. So you can ramp up protein production pretty quickly. Okay, now to 20. That's the basics of translation, and so we're really through with all the basics of gene expression, but what we see here is something that I talked about first in the chapter that looked at all the various organelles. When we first learned about the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which looks rough to us because it is studded with a bunch of ribosomes on its membrane surface, I told you that the job of that rough ER is to modify brand new, newly made polypeptides, right? Well, some polypeptides don't need to be modified after they're produced by translation. Some of them are just ready to go. They're in their final form. Others need to be modified after translation. So translation produces a polypeptide, but some polypeptides require what's called post-translational modification. And that's where the endoplasmic reticulum comes into play. Now, at the time we were talking about ribosomes in that same chapter, I told you that we have the terms free ribosome and bound ribosome. You remember these? It's the same structure, A ribosome is the same, whether it's free or bound. But a free ribosome means it's on its own in the cytoplasm. A bound ribosome means it's, at the moment, connected to the endoplasmic reticular membrane. All right? But all translation, whether this is a translation of a protein that's going to need modification or not, all translation, or all polypeptides, start being translated, start being built on a free ribosome in the cytoplasm. Okay? So the question is, how does the cell know whether this growing polypeptide is going to be one of these that does not need to be modified, or whether it's going to be one of these that needs to be modified? And the answer is shown in this cartoon. The polypeptide is a sequence of amino acids. It's coming off of the assembly line at the ribosome, right? It's getting longer and longer. Well, the ones that are the polypeptides that are going to need to be modified tell the cell that by virtue of a particular sequence of amino acids that's part of the polypeptide itself. This green section, this first several amino acids, is a specific sequence that tells the cell, okay, I'm one of these ones that need to be modified. If there isn't this signal peptide, the green part, then the entire polypeptide will be built where it is in the cytoplasm, and it'll be released in the cytoplasm, and it'll be ready to go. But the ones that need modification have this signal peptide, and when that comes off the assembly line, as you should expect by now, signals require some sort of receptor for anything to happen. And that involves this orange protein. This is a signal recognition particle, SRP. Okay, it's a protein, though, specifically. And proteins can have any shape you want. This happens to have just the right shape to recognize that signal peptide. And so it will bind to that signal peptide. And when that happens, that causes this entire complex, this entire translation complex, which is the ribosome, the mRNA, and the emerging polypeptide, plus the signal recognition particle, all of that is one big complex, gets translocated over to the membrane that makes up the rough ER. The signal recognition protein, the orange thing, then, because of a shape on a different part of its surface, is able to connect to dock to, one of the protein complexes that make up a pore in the endoplasmic reticulum's membrane. Okay, so it's docking right here. And when it docks it, it positions this emerging polypeptide in exactly the perfect position for it to get strung as it grows through the pore into the lumen, the hollow interior of the endoplasmic reticulum, which is exactly where it needs to be because the job of the ER is to modify these newly made polypeptides. All right, so you can see it gets longer and longer, and now that polypeptide that needs help is exactly where it needs to be in the lumen of the ER. What kind of modification is depends on the polypeptide, but the ER will take care of it, package it into a vesicle, and send it on its way to the Golgi, as we've discussed before. 21. Well, we've talked about this before. We've already had this example of a mutation that causes sickle cell disease in humans, which is the smallest scale mutation that can happen. But mutation in general is any change to a DNA sequence from what it was before. And it's an accident of some sort that happens, whether it's just totally random by accident or because certain kind of something from the environment causes it, it's still some change to the DNA. And the reason I said it's the smallest scale change is because it involves a single position along the sequence. But it's DNA, so there's two strands, right? A single position is called a base pair because you have one nitrogenous base at that position on one strand and a corresponding one on the other strand. So it's one unit, but it's a base pair because of the double strands. Anyway, as you see here, the wild type, which is the DNA before it's mutated, is CTT and GAA as the other one. But the CTT part of it, that's part of the template strand. Remember, a gene has a template strand, and the other strand, it gets ignored. CTT, along with all the other codons, this is just one codon, is what's supposed to be there. But if that T gets mutated into A, if some sort of mutagen, as we call them, chemicals or some other thing in the environment that can cause these changes, turns it into an A instead of a T, and it becomes permanent. In other words, it eludes the detection of the proofreading mechanism. So the cell has no idea it ever happened. It thinks it's normal now, and it's going to just read it as normal. Well, CAT corresponds in mRNA to GUA, right? C specifies GAU and TA. When you look up GUA in the genetic code, it specifies valine as the amino acid. But the normal, unmutated codon was CTT. That means the mRNA is going to be GAA, and when you look up GAA, it's not valine, it's glutamic acid. So this is a mutation in which all of the other amino acids are right and in their right position, except this one, which is instead of being glutamic acid like in normal hemoglobin, it's valine, because it got the wrong instruction from the now changed or mutated DNA. And that makes a huge difference, because the specific sequence, which is the primary structure of DNA, of protein, affects all the higher levels of structure. It's misshapen and it doesn't do its job. Yeah.
So what happens with the cell? Does the cell react differently?
Well, the cell that this affects is a red blood cell whose job it is to pack millions of copies of hemoglobin into one cell. When the hemoglobin individually, and all of them will be wrong because the person has the mutation, so all the millions of copies are going to be misshapen. It changes the shape of the cell from normal biconcave disc into a sickle shape. That's why the disease got its name. But also the individual hemoglobins start clumping together, and so they can't do their job of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide. And that's why the disease is so devastating. Okay, so that's just one specific example. But 22 shows you other examples of so-called point mutations. These are just like the previous slide, that sickle cell one. Those were point mutations, which are small-scale mutations because they affect just a single base pair, or if not a single, a very small number of base pairs. We'll talk about larger-scale mutations in a different unit. But these are point mutations. And notice there's two columns here. At the top, though, you have the so-called wild-type DNA, meaning the DNA before the mutation happens. On the left side, we have what are called base pair substitutions. Now, substitution means something gets replaced by something else, right? So it's a mutation because it's a different sequence of DNA. But in a substitution, the overall length of the sequence, the number of nucleotides, in other words, does not change, right? It's just that one of them is a different letter compared to what it was supposed to be. So in this wild type, it was supposed to be ACCG there. Instead, it's ACCA. That's the mutation. But since it's a substitution, you're not adding or taking away any nucleotides. You're just swapping one out. And that makes a big difference that we'll talk about in a minute. Anyway, one way this can happen, this base pair substitution, is to result in what's called a silent mutation. Has nothing to do with sound, but silent means unnoticed. A silent mutation is a mutation. The DNA is now different. But a silent mutation won't have any effect at all, because despite the mutation, exactly the correct protein will still be produced. And the reason that this can happen is because of the redundancy of the genetic code. Remember, we talked about the fact that the genetic code is redundant because 64 is greater than 60, greater than 20. So there's more than one kind of codon that can specify the same amino acid. Well, in this case, the normal wild-type codon, or DNA triplet, is CCG. That specifies GGC, and the and the mRNA, right? If you look up GGC, you see that it corresponds to glycine. That's what it's supposed to be. Well, this has now mutated into CCA instead of CCG. So when it gets transcribed into mRNA, it's GGU instead of GGC. But because of redundancy, GGU, when you look it up, also specifies glycine. So yes, it's a mutation, but you still make exactly the correct protein because it's two ways of specifying the same amino acid. That's a silent mutation. No effect at all on the trait. On the other hand, you can have the same thing happen, but result in missense. Missense refers to getting the amino acid wrong. And that happens whenever a DNA triplet gets changed so that when it gets transcribed into a codon in the mRNA, it's now a codon that specifies some other amino acid rather than the wild type. So instead of being glycine, this one specifies serine. That's missense. You get the word wrong, basically, is what missense means. All right? But missense still makes the correct length of amino acids. It's just one of those amino acids is wrong. That might be a big deal. It might not. It depends on the polypeptide. In the case of sickle cell, it makes a big deal. Okay, then you have a nonsense outcome on the bottom. Nonsense is far worse than missense as far as getting the information correct. It happens the same way. There's a mutation. But in this case, it changes the codon in the mRNA from the normal one to one of the three stop codons. So it prematurely stops the production. It makes the however many amino acids long it is at that point, it tells it you're done. And of course, that's going to have a very high chance of not working if you're not making the entire string of beads. So that's a nonsense. Now the other half, the right side, these are not substitutions. These are either insertions or deletions. As the words imply, insertion mutations are changes that put an extra DNA nucleotide in between two that were there, and a deletion takes one out without replacing it with anything. So whether it's an insertion or a deletion, those kinds of mutations do change the length of the sequence, right? They make it either longer or shorter. And that has a drastic effect because it doesn't affect just the one codon in which the mutation occurs. It affects all the other codons until you get to the end. And that's because of the fact that you can't have a one-to-one correspondence between mRNA nucleotides and amino acids, right? Because you only have four nucleotide types and you have 20 amino acid types. That's why you have to use a codon. Well, codons are like words in a sentence to us. Just pretend for the moment that we only use three-letter words. We don't, of course. But the fact that we don't, we can use words of any length, doesn't matter to us, because how do we tell words apart in a sentence? They have a space between them, right? So we can tell where words start and end. Well, there are no spaces in an mRNA transcript. There's just a continuous sequence of nucleotides. But you can get away without having spaces if you have the rule that all words are exactly three letters long. As long as you set the frame of reference to begin with, and that's what the start codon does. That tells the messenger, or tells the ribosome, here's where the first word is, and then take each word as the three next ones after that. If you get that wrong, it results in what's called a frame shift, a shift in the frame of reference. And you can analogize this with language, using just three-letter words from English, for instance. There's all kinds of examples you could use, but for instance, the red cat ate the dry dog or whatever, right? We know we can make sense of this because of the spaces, but imagine there aren't any spaces. You just have to read them three letters at a time. Well, if you insert a Q here, then that changes it into THQ, ERE, DCA. You see what I'm doing here? It changes every codon after that, a frame shift does. And the same thing would happen if you take one out, right? So the effect on the protein is drastic, and there's almost no chance that it's going to do what it's supposed to do. It's an entirely different protein with an entirely different sequence of amino acids. So those have much stronger effects, insertions or deletions. But functionally, they can result in either nonsense, extensive missense, or, once again, premature stopping nonsense. Okay? It just depends on how it happens. But that's the difference. So those are major categories of point mutations. 23. I've talked already about a polyribosome, which any kind of cell can produce. Remember, a polyribosome is one messenger RNA plus all the ribosomes that are simultaneously translating it. Well, what we see happening here on the bottom does not occur in all cells. This happens only in prokaryotes because they don't have this extra complication of having a nucleus that the mRNA has to get out of, right? The DNA and the ribosomes, and therefore transcription and translation, occur in the same compartment. So only in prokaryotes do you have what's happening down here. This is one gene. The blue is the DNA. And that simultaneously, that one gene is being transcribed at different stages. These are individual RNA polymerase molecules transcribing it. So each of these emerging red mRNA transcripts, once they're all built, will eventually be identical. They're just in different stages of being completed. And what you see here is that for a prokaryotic cell, the mRNA doesn't even have to finish being built before it can start being used in translation. As soon as you have enough hanging off for a ribosome to come along, you can start translating the still incomplete transcript. And each one of these is a polyribosome. So this single gene in a prokaryote is being used in very small amount of time to produce many identical copies of the protein. Which is a big deal if you're a single-celled organism, right? If you need that protein, you need it quickly. Because if you don't have it, you'll lose that cell, which is your entire individuality, right? They can't afford to lose one cell. Well, 24 is the final slide of the unit. I was afraid I wasn't going to get through it because you guys had two fewer days than my other... Sucks in spring that there's two fewer days. That's an entire week less than my other section. But we made it through. 24 is really no new information. It's a summary slide. But it summarizes eukaryotic gene expression. Let's quickly go through it, though, with the remaining minutes. Remember that gene expression refers to the combination of transcription first and translation after. Since this is a eukaryotic cell, transcription is occurring in the nucleus. Transcription always has to happen where the DNA is. It's the only part of gene expression that actually involves the DNA, the gene. And so you have the blue gene, and only one of those strands is used in expression, right? That's the template strand. The other one just gets set aside temporarily. The RNA polymerase molecule recognizes the promoter, binds to it with the help of transcription factors, and starts building the mRNA transcript. Once that's done, the pre-mRNA, because this is a eukaryotic cell, then needs to be post-transcriptionally modified by putting on the yellow ends, the poly A tail and the 5' cap, and by using a spliceosome to recognize and cut out the introns, sew together all the exons. That leads to the mature mRNA, which because of those yellow ends is able to get through the nuclear pore out into the cytoplasm where the ribosomes are. Then you have the three phases of translation occurring. initiation, elongation, and then termination. And that involves, of course, ribosomal RNA, that's part of the ribosome itself, messenger RNA, the transcript itself, many tRNAs, which get charged individually by many different kinds of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzymes. That's happening right here. And once a stop codon gets read, that's termination, right? And the entire polypeptide, however long it is, which can vary drastically depending on the actual one. It can be 20 amino acids for a very small peptide, or thousands of amino acids in it for a complex polypeptide. Anyway, it gets eventually released from the last tRNA carrying it, and it's on its own. And if not shown here, if this happens to be one that needs to be modified, then before it gets anywhere near being completed, it signals by a peptide that it needs to be docked to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum to be modified and packaged. All right, so that is the link. The gene expression represents the link between DNA and traits, because as I keep telling you, traits of an organism are directly the result of specific proteins that the organism is able to produce. But DNA tells the cell via gene expression how to make those proteins, and therefore DNA indirectly gives organisms its traits. That's the unit, and so don't forget the Scantron on Thursday, or on Wednesday. Wednesday. Yeah. That's what I was saying. It just depends on the individual polypeptides. Some of them, for instance, this is just one example. One example is that some polypeptides need to get rid of that methionine that they all have to start with. They don't have any choice of getting it because it's the start codon that specifies methionine. But for some polypeptides, if you keep that methionine, it won't have the right shape. Therefore, that's one example. You cleave that off. But other examples would be you add things other than amino acids to them.